The following is part one of Dr. Ken Boa's teaching series on relational spirituality.
We're going to be looking at Conformed to His Image, a book that really approaches the whole spiritual life from a variety of facets. And I want to talk about what I call relational spirituality, or the idea of loving God completely, loving self correctly, loving others compassionately. And it's the whole idea of seeing life as really ultimately all about relationships, first with God, then understanding who we are and whose we are in light of that relationship with God, and then having allowed God to define us rather than the world, then we are secure enough, significant enough, and satisfied enough, the more we come to grasp who we are in Him, to be capable of loving others with compassion and other-centered love. So the whole process then really always starts, as Scripture always does, with God. In the beginning, God. In the beginning was the Word. The Genesis 1, the John 1 imagery there is, in fact, absolutely central to our grasp. I want to stress, as we've said so many times before, that relationships are what life's all about. We see that the biblical worldview is always about that, a person. That there are three basic worldviews that I'm not going to go into now, though I'm going to give you a little presentation sometime on that sometime, a little PowerPoint thing every so often, maybe every 6 weeks or so, you know, I'll throw it up on the screen just to, you know, keep you going. Don't do it every week, I'll spoil you. But I'll give you a little presentation on that, but essentially there are three basic worldviews, and one of those worldviews kind of defines us downward. And it says basically that ultimate reality is just matter and energy and space and time. It's material. There's nothing above. And so really, this purports to be scientific, but really it's a worldview that says that there's nothing more than the cosmos. That's all there is. And that the cosmos on this worldview is utterly indifferent to your existence. That's a real exciting prospect, that you are and I are just merely little cosmic blips who come for a moment and then we're gone. And frankly, that's the truth not just of your life, but of the whole human race, in an utterly impersonal and indifferent universe. And because people find that increasingly difficult to live with those implications, they switch to the opposite extreme, and they have this what I call the new religious synthesis. The new religious synthesis kind of pulls from all sorts of directions, called spirituality sometimes, and that's the funny part. That word spirituality can be good, but it can also be really just a cover-all for a lot of what I call screwballitude. A lot of screwball notions there that have nothing to do with truth, but rather everything to do with what people want. And it's the God people may want, but not the God who is. And I think a lot of people pursue the God they want instead of the God who is. And so in that viewpoint, you can reduce it. There are a lot of variations informed by Eastern thought, New Age concepts, and so forth. Really what happens here is that ultimate reality may not be material, may be spiritual or energy or some force, but they don't want it to be personal, because as soon as the it becomes a he, you got a problem. What's the problem? You see, it's nice to believe that you're God and we're all gods and our problem is ignorance. You know, so all we have to do is overcome our ignorance and we discover our divinity within. That sounds real heady at first. Sounds actually similar to Genesis 3. That you shall be as, what? Gods. And that was the original temptation in the garden. Be as gods yourself. And still to this day, all we have is new packaging on the old lie. I want to say, though, that that worldview, we might call it the quest for the transcendent without a person, that worldview may claim to give us meaning or some kind of sense of the warm fuzzies, something around. But at the same time, there's no real sense of a person behind it all. Only in the biblical worldview, only in a worldview that says, in some kind of a concept, there only in a theistic worldview, is there the idea that ultimate reality is both a person and that this person is infinite. He's infinite, and he's also personal. And only in the Christian worldview is this person a community of persons, the three in one, the lover and the beloved, and the love that flows between them. So only on Christian theism do you have it. An account. of how ultimate reality is, in fact, a being who's in communion with, there are three in one. One God, three persons, co-equal, co-eternal, which forms the basis in the Trinitarian union and of unity and diversity, the I and the thou, the lover and the beloved, as well as the possibility of communion, communication, and fellowship, other-centeredness. All of that really is at the very heart of things, so that we, in our best moments of sacrificial love, of gracious care for other people, of putting the needs of others above ourselves, in our best moments of intimacy, we are merely shadows of a more profound love and a profound relationship. The best experience of relationships is only 1,000 removes from the wellspring of true relationships. This is a fallen world. I think we've looked around and checked it out and seen that to be the case. All you need to do, you know, the doctrine of fallenness really doesn't require a whole lot of real proof. All you need to do is look at any newspaper any day of the year, and you've got it right in front of you. It's really the one really major biblical doctrine that requires no empirical evidence to support it. I mean, it's constantly surrounded by it. The fact is, we know every day that people do things that are foolish, selfish, ugly, immoral, brutal, and all those things are occurring, sadly, even as we speak around the world. It's a tragic world. And we are tragic people because we are like kings who've lost our position as being kings. I'm going to make a comment on that. But somehow we've been deposed, and our former greatness, our former glory is now gone. But we long for the return. We long for something more than this. And I think that longing really animates us if we really look and listen to our hearts. God's created our hearts with Him in mind. And even when we may try to deny Him, you can't eliminate the heart. And in the very core of our beings, we desire more than what this world can offer. So I want to just focus on this idea then of God as a relational being. I was talking about the idea of spirituality and topics of spirituality. It's interesting, when you listen to interviews and commentaries on this, it's a crazy quilt. You just get these contradictory, chaotic notions. It's like what Jeremiah said in Jeremiah chapter 10 when he spoke of it as a discipline of delusion to chase after spirituality as if it were a matter of preference and not a matter of truth, of pertaining to truth. We go for what we prefer rather than what is true. And in doing so then, Jeremiah calls it really a discipline. They are altogether stupid and foolish in their discipline of delusion. We deceive ourselves when we go for what we prefer rather than what is. And we live in a relativistic world where people are losing their mooring and they do really not have a real sense of what significance is. And yet we all are reminded of what's significant. Whenever we think of death, for example, we are forced to deal with something that really is there. We're encountering that concept. And when we think about that, we have to ask. It asks us to raise the question of life's fundamental answers. I was reading about someone who attended an Easter morning service that was forever etched in her mind. The Easter morning service was held in a cemetery. That's an interesting idea, isn't it? Where they were surrounded by silent stones, each of those marking a life that was put to rest. And the sting of death was surrounding her. In her case, her father had died. I myself am an orphan. I've buried my mother, and then I buried my father. And I spoke at both of their funerals. Not an easy thing to do, to speak at your parents' funeral. And in doing so, the only thing that really gave me real consolation was the reality that there is a true hope that goes beyond the mocking of the grave. It reminds me of that imagery there from 1 Corinthians 15 when Paul says, when this perishable will have put on the imperishable, verse 54, and this mortal will have put on immortality, then will come about the saying that is written, death is swallowed up in victory. O death, where is your victory? O death, where is your sting? The sting of death is sin, and the power of sin is the law. law. What he's saying there is death is a consequence of sin, and sin is rebellion against the character of God. And because of our rebellion against God, the wages of sin is death. Death always means separation. It means alienation. And we are separated, first of all, from God as a consequence of sin in Genesis 3. Secondly, we're separated or alienated from ourselves as a consequence of our alienation with God. So now we are even pulled within ourselves. Third, we're alienated from others because we are alienated with our relationship with God and ourselves. And fourth, we have an alienation, an estrangement with the created order. It's not as it was meant to be. And so all of that is finally really an alienation, a separation. Things are out of order. Things are out of kilter. They're out of balance. Something has gone wrong then in our lives, and we know it. And so we are reminded then of the issue. Is God sovereign? Is there something more? Is there anything that can transcend death? And when I think of that question, I think of Jesus' words in John chapter 11. As some of you know, in November 7th, a film that's going to be released. It'll be the release of the first film ever based solely on the Gospel of John, called The Gospel According to John. It'll be word for word the Good News translation all the way through. No change in the script. The script is the Gospel of John. And so they have to conform everything they do to that text. And in doing so, I was sent an invitation to see a screening of it. I didn't have a chance to go. I was busy that night. But they sent me a little DVD that had two samples, one from John chapter 6, one from John chapter 8. The John 8 was with the woman caught in adultery. And I thought it was what I saw was very, very well done. So my hope is that this will be a gripping and a powerful film, a faithful rendition. But you know in that film then, you'll hear words like this. When Jesus encounters Martha, and she says, "Lord, if you'd been here, my brother would not have died," referring to the loss of her brother Lazarus, who was Jesus' friend. Why did you delay? She was implying you could have come here earlier. In fact, you read earlier in the account, he waited an extra 4 days before he left. Why did he do it? His disciples thought initially it's because the Jews were seeking his life. But then he told his disciples, "Arise, we're going to go back there into Judea." Thomas almost cynically says, "Let's all go and let's all die with him." In other words, he says, he's crazy, but we'll all go and die with him. At least he went with him. But the point here is that he could have come earlier. Why did he wait? He used this moment to demonstrate something very clear. He will have been dead now. He would have been dead 4 days. And recall when he would go there, there was no question, this was no near-death experience. In fact, when he was going to tell them to roll the stone out of the way, recall what they said in objection? What did they say? "By this time, Lord, there'll be a stench." Or as the King James says, by this time he stinketh. he's decomposed. It's a little late. You don't resurrect a decaying corpse. He wanted to make sure that this was no near-death thing. This was certifiable. Because he wanted to demonstrate something through his friend, namely his authority even over the final enemy, which is death, which has lost its victory and lost its sting. In Jesus Christ's death, there was the death of death. And ultimately, we wait for the realization that in him, we too will be overcomers. And that the grave will not have the last word. And therefore, in that word, I had hope with my mother, with my father, and with other loved ones and friends who have now passed away. And who, as I get older, will seem to pass away quicker and quicker. And the reality is I'm losing my aunts and my uncles. I'm losing people that I've loved all around me now. And frankly, it's only a matter of time for all of us, if Jesus doesn't return soon, that we too will experience that. Although Jesus makes this wonderful promise to Martha prior to raising Lazarus from the dead, she goes on to say in verse 22, "Even now I know that whatever you ask of God, God will give you." I'm not sure what she was expecting when she said that. But Jesus said to her, "Your brother will rise again." Well, she affirmed that. The Jews had some idea of a general resurrection of time at the end of history. She said, I know that he will rise again in the resurrection on the last day. They had a general idea of a resurrection that would be corporate all at once in the last day. But then Jesus makes this powerful I am statement, one of the seven great I am statements in the Gospel of John. I am the resurrection and the life. Awesome statement. He who believes in me will live even if he dies. And everyone who lives and believes in me will never die. This is a powerful word because Jesus is making an audacious claim, a claim that is only something that could be warranted by the claim to be God himself. He, the incarnate God-man, has the authority, and because of his death on the cross, it will now be possible for us to experience life. His death on our behalf will overcome the four alienations. Even now, it's begun. Even now, we begin to experience some of the overcoming from the inside out. When we transfer our trust to Jesus Christ, when we are new creatures, regenerated by the Spirit of God, when we are given a new spirit by virtue of receiving Christ, several things take place. Among them, the alienation between ourselves and God, that estrangement, that barrier is now overcome. Therefore, we have peace with God because we have been justified by Him. We have now peace, not estrangement with God. Because we have peace with God, we now begin to experience a quality of newness of life inside. There's a new dimension, a new power, a new source, something that's inside us, something that's a wellspring that wells up into eternal life. It's the Spirit of God in us. So even inside of us, we discover that there's something new. In addition, we begin to discover a new source of power that can even begin, not perfectly in this life, we know that only too well, but it can begin to overcome the alienation as we become other-centered lovers of others. Even when they reject us, betray us, refuse to reciprocate, we have a source of power that can enable us to continue to love in spite of that, knowing that our identity is not based upon their love for us, but based upon the Father's love for us and by Jesus' embrace. So that you are secure in His love, even when we experience the pain. I do not minimize pain, but even when we experience the pain of a lack of reciprocity, even so, we know who we are, and we know where we're going, and we know where we came from. And because of that, we can be secure enough to be capable of loving and serving other people in a way we couldn't have done before. Again, Christianity is not some religion, it's a relationship. It is not a set of rules. Instead, it's a source of power. It's a person, not a program. And when we come to see that it's all about this person, a personal presence, we begin to discover that Jesus didn't just say, here's what you need to do, but rather, here's who you have become and here's my power in your life. I fear that most of my life when I've heard sermons, the sermons I've heard typically center around the idea of what you need to do. Do, 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 do. Be a good person. You've been very bad last week, so now shape up or ship out. So basically you have this cathartic experience. You go there and the guy kind of verbally browbeats you a little bit. Yeah, you're right. I'm bad. I'm bad. You're right. You're right. And you almost have this emotional, kind of a perverse need to be kind of browbeaten and whipped a little bit. So yeah, I'll be better next week. Of course, you come back in the same condition. Because they keep telling you, you need to be better fathers. You need to be better parents. You need to be better husbands and wives. You need to be good people at work. You need to be honest. You have to have good character. They always talk about Ephesians 4 through 6 without talking about Ephesians 1 to 3. They talk about Colossians 3 and 4 without looking at Colossians 1 and 2. They talk about Romans 12 to 16 without looking at Romans 1 to 11. In other words, they talk all about doing without the being. But Paul puts being first because he says you cannot do until you have become a new being. And until you grasp who and whose you are, you won't have the source of power to be able to be living these lives. The Christian life is not difficult. It's impossible. And so you have to understand that. Telling people you need to clean up your act is like telling roaches to keep out of the kitchen. I mean, it's a kind of a scary idea there, the idea of trying to clean up your act. You don't have the power to do that, but Jesus in you has that authority and that power. And what I'm saying is that the only person who can live the Christian life is Jesus Christ. You can't do it. He can do it. He's done it. Now, how does he do it? He chooses to live it in you and through you to the degree to which you invite him to do that. You can either walk by the flesh and go back to your own self-based living at any moment in the day, or you can walk by the Spirit. That's why I've said you can do any activity either in the flesh or in the Spirit. You can drive in the flesh, or you can drive in the Spirit. You can talk to someone in the flesh, you can talk to someone in the Spirit. You can put a deal together in the flesh, you can put it together in the Spirit. I don't believe there's any secular activity that cannot be infused by the grace of God. And when it's infused by the grace of God, when you welcome him into your details of your life and into your plans and into your day, when you invite him into that rather than to a portion of your life, what you begin to discover is that the ordinary takes on the spirit of the extraordinary. That there's splendor in the ordinary. When I was speaking on Monday night, I did my first film presentation. The first Monday of the month, I'm going to do Monday night at the movies, always the first Monday. And I chose for this first film, Chariots of Fire, November 3rd, that one's going to be Gladiator. I pull out spiritual themes in films. I believe films are powerful because they're stories. And they tell us about reality, and they point beyond themselves to a good film, a good story, points beyond itself to spiritual lessons, does it not? There's a great scene where Eric Little, the Flying Scotsman, is told by actually the head of the missionary society that God's called him and given him an ability. He's certainly called him to be for China, but he's also given him an ability that's quite extraordinary. How fast are you? His friend says he's extraordinary, and he is told, Eric, you can peel a spud to the glory of God if you do it with excellence. There's not a thing you can do that cannot be done to the glory of God if you do it with excellence and for the name. Run, he says, in God's name, and let the world watch in wonder. That's a great idea. Running is not any is as spiritual as being in missionary endeavor if it's done for the glory of God. And then that film, I sought to contrast a man who was driven, Harold Abrahams, who was a great man and a great runner. And he won his race, his 100-meter race in the 1924 Paris Olympics. But he ran it for a different reason than Eric won his 400-meter race. Eric was running to the glory of God. Abrahams was running to prove that he really was somebody, in spite of the fact that he had experienced anti-Semitic comments and experiences all his life as a Jew. And so one was a driven man, the other one was called. You and I can be driven or called in life. You become a called man when you see that you're called for something more than just impressing people and proving that you're somebody. You are given a higher and more glorious destiny than just impressing people and proving you're going to be somebody. Some of us, as I've sometimes said, are driven to accomplish, perhaps to prove to a father who may already be dead that you will amount to something when they said you'll amount to nothing. Or to answer the objection, how come you can't be like your brother or like so-and-so? And we buy into these lies, these false scripts, and we become driven men rather than called men. Jesus calls us to something bigger than that. He calls us, in fact, to experience the pleasure of God. And so in that great line here about what it means to experience God's pleasure, when I run, I feel his pleasure, you have to ask yourself this question: what is it that you can do that when you do it, you feel the pleasure of God? And pray and discover, I promise you, it'll relate to a gift, to an ability that you've already been given. It may be to run a company with diligence and excellence for the glory of God. And then in doing so, as you harness those skills and abilities that God has forged in you, you can feel his pleasure, even in the apparently mundane, because there's no sacred secular distinction. So in saying all this, then, I want to move us on then into my first concept, which is loving God completely. So I'm going to start with that. Then, as we go on, we'll look at the other two aspects. What does it mean to love self correctly and then others compassionately? But I want to focus this morning, and maybe a couple of weeks, on what does it mean to love God completely? God, as I say, is a relational being, and you and I have been created and called to be in his image. And therefore, because he's a relational being, what are you called to? What kind of relationships? Mediocrity? You're called to right relationships. You're called to really being a person who champions and models right relationships, a right way of relating to people. May I suggest something about this concept in Scripture of righteousness, for example? That actually the Scriptures, when they give us these commandments and these ideas, the laws and so forth, and talk about righteousness, do you understand that it's not about do's and don'ts? It's about right relationships with people. You can't sin against an object. You can't sin, for example, against a building. You may destroy the building, but you don't ask its forgiveness. You may crash into a car, but you don't say, "Please forgive me, Mr. Audi." The fact is that it's not objects. Life isn't about that. What is it about? It's always about people. And so we're consequently called to then have right relationships with people. And so righteousness has to do with right relationships, first with God and then with others. And so when doing that, then, I want to look at the causeless love of God, the measureless love of God, and the ceaseless love of God. Because it's that love, which is prior to our love, that'll empower us to become lovers of other people. Now, as I said before, and so often, that God, being a community of three persons, invites us to respond to his relational initiatives. And his relational image, the imagery of his initiative, is found in gift giving, that he gives. God so loved the world that what did he do? He gave. And this is love. Not that we loved us, God, but that God loved us and what? Gave or sent his only begotten Son so we might live through him. The idea is that God is always a giver, always previous to our response. We are the ones who must respond to his initiatives in relationship. In spite of the fact that we are people who have inherited rebellion and sin, in spite of that, Christ bore the awesome price of our guilt, and he launched and inaugurated what is called in Hebrews 10:20 a new and living way. And this new and living way overcomes the barrier to the personal relationship with him and causes us to be people who begin to discover our purpose. And part of your purpose is this: to know God, to love him, enjoy him, and honor him forever. That the more you honor and seek his pleasure, the more you will be satisfied. That the true satisfaction in life will always be a byproduct of the pursuit of God. So you know what the two great commandments are. I don't need to remind you of them. What are they? Maybe I do need to remind you. Here they are. What's the first one? This is great. I love it when things work together like this. You shall love the Lord your God in what way? Then what? Your heart, then soul, then your mind, and in another text it goes on to say, in your strength. I want you to notice, is that outward in or inside out? It's inside out. It always starts with the core of your being and then moves out into your outward actions. Your strength has to do with your actions, your physical choices, you see. So you start from the inside and it works out in the outside. This is the great and foremost commandment. It's about love and loving a person who has already loved us first. The second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. Jesus said on these two commandments depend the whole law and the prophets. How can he do that? Remember in the law and the prophets, there were lots of commands. There were a lot of positive and negative commandments. In fact, they added them up and the Jews came up with 613 in total. 365 negative commandments, 248, I think it was, figured you'd do the math for the positive. The idea was that, by the way, the problem with the positive commandment is you can't measure it. You can't know how you're doing. You know when you're stealing or not, but when we're called to love God, how do you measure that? But anyway, there are commands, bunches of them. And then those commands you can actually kind of reduce down to 10, can't you? They're called the 10 Commandments. This is not hard stuff. I know it's early in the morning, but I think you can follow this. So here the Decalogue becomes really, in a way, a summary, because you'll notice the sequence. What starts first? How does it begin? It starts with God, and then it ends with others, doesn't it? The first four commandments deal with your relationship with God, and then the last six commandments deal with your relationship with people. This is not accidental. This is intentional. God says, I'm a jealous God, and I will not take second place in your life. If you want to know me, I will be preeminent. And I don't even want to be regarded as God first and so second and so third. I'm not to be put on a list like that. I am preeminent over all. I'm in a category by myself, you see. This is what really, in effect, he's saying. That he is to be ultimately and completely preeminent, unique in all things. He is the focus of your heart. If he is not, what is? You must ask yourself this question every day. What's at the center of my heart? And if it is not knowing God, if it is not Jesus Christ, may I ask you what it is? And I promise you, it will be something in the created order, which is called an idol. When you give your ultimate allegiance in your heart to something in the created order, that's idolatry. You are worshiping and serving the creature rather than the creator. The creature might be position, possession, power, prestige, performance, lots of P's. Or you can do some W's. It can be wealth and wisdom and women and wine and all kinds of other things like Solomon pursued, you see. And none of that, and wit, none of that worked for him. But men give their lives in exchange for something. And you have to ask yourself, what's at the very center of your being? What do you want more than anything else will tell you about yourself? What do you desire? What is your heart's desire? What do you want more than anything else? I'm going to close my thoughts with a little comment here, if I can find it. Yeah, of something I taught just recently. 6 questions I'm going to use in Scripture to help you ask yourself these questions. These are questions we are asked in Scripture, and they're good questions for us to answer. First question in the Bible. What's the first question in the Bible? Come on. You got to be early. It's got to be Genesis. It's got to be early in Genesis. Come on. Work with me here. Toss me a bone. Come on. What do you have? First question in the Bible, where are you? Where are you? Adam, where are you? He knew where he was. Adam was trying to hide from God's manifest presence. Trying to veil yourself from omniscience is not a good track to follow, you see. You're not going to be able to pull that one off. Omniscience, omnipotence, and omnipresence, you're not going to hide. You're not going to escape. When we have strayed, he asked that question, where are you? You know, he'll ask you that question when you stray. Whether you don't know him, he'll ask you, if you don't know Christ yet, he'll ask you, where are you? Even when you come to know him, he'll ask you, where are you? When you've moved away from him. Because if there's someone who's moved, it's been you. He won't move. You're the one. It's like the guy who was, the wife who was complaining to her husband. When we dated, you used to sit right, we used to be cuddling, and whenever I was driving the car, you'd have your arm around me. What's happened to our relationship? He says, I didn't move. He's still behind the wheel. Who moved? She moved. She's complaining because he's not holding her. She's on the opposite side of the car. It's kind of like us and God in a way. Second question I want you to ask is this. As we stand before him, Jesus asked this question, and I know this is the first question Jesus asks. What do you seek? What are you looking for? That's a very perceptive question. It's in John chapter 1. I think it's verse 38. Look it up. I think that's right. But he asks the disciples of John, what are you seeking? What are you looking for? Your answer to that question will determine what you find. You are, in the end, the sum total of your desires. What you seek for will shape who you are and what you're like. What your pursuits are will determine what you attain and what your character will be like. If you pursue secondary goods, you'll end up with secondary goods, and there'll be emptiness in the end. They'll leave you in bitterness and disappointment at the end of your life. You must pursue the first things first. So what do you seek? Third question. Where are you when we have strayed? What do you seek, or what do you want when you stand before Jesus? Third, whom are you looking for as we search? John 20:15. Whom are you looking for? Because Jesus is right in front of her. She's looking for him, but she doesn't realize it's him after the resurrection. Earlier on, Jesus asked this penetrating question to his disciples near Caesarea Philippi. Who do you say that I am? Who do you say that I am? And ultimately, every man will have to give an account and answer that question. And frankly, a lot of people are trying to redefine Jesus today. A lot of people who are in churches, both ministers, congregations, have been creating a new Jesus, not a Jesus of the Gospels, but a Jesus that they want. A patronizing, tolerant Jesus. Actually, I find Jesus to be utterly intolerant of sin and hypocrisy. He reserved his harshest words for the religious hypocrites, called them hypocrites 7 times in Matthew 23. I think that there's a little difference when you read the Gospels and listen to people's account of them. Who do you say that I am? Either he's the living God or he's not. Either he's a liar or a lunatic or the Lord, if we look at it to use that trilemma. Here's another question. It's a question he asked in John 5 to the man who had been... Let's give you the exact verses for that. Yeah, it's in John 5, verse 6, where there was a man who was lying there. He'd been ill for 38 years. When Jesus saw him lying there and knew that he'd already been a long time in that condition, he said to him, and this at first will seem like a dumb question, do you want to get well? The guy's been coming to this pool, Bethesda, having five porticos, and these lay a multitude of those who were sick, blind, lame, and withered, waiting for the moving of the waters. Apparently they thought that if an angel moved the waters, the first one in might get healed. This guy shows up for 38 years, waiting to be healed in front of the pool of Bethesda. So Jesus comes up to him, 38 years he's showing up every day, do you want to get well? Why would he ask such a question? I'll tell you why. Do you understand what will happen if you do get well? Your whole identity will be changed. You can no longer define yourself now as a person who needs to be helped and lifted and carried here. Your whole life will change. And so it is with knowing Jesus. Come to know me, he says, and everything will change. The rules will change. You sure you want me? You sure? Is that what you want? You understand the idea? This is not trivial stuff. We want, most people, we want just enough of the Bible to make us comfortable. But we don't want any more, because if we want more, if there's more, it may change us in our character. We don't want to change our too much change. We just want to get comfortable. So we hope we want just enough of Christianity to have a better business, better marriage, better family and kids, and better life, better health. A lot of people come to Jesus for better things like that. That's not why you come to Jesus. Nor is he promising that in this life those things will necessarily get better. They may not. What he's promising is if you come to know me, I'll radically change you inside out, and I'll give you a destiny and a hope and a future where the pain of this world is nothing in comparison with one moment in his pleasure. 70 years of pain compared to 5 minutes in his pleasure, and I promise you, you'd choose the pain to get the pleasure. But it's not 70 years of pain and 5 minutes of pleasure. It's a millisecond of pain in comparison with an eternity in his presence. You see, you do the math. If you will last forever, this will seem, and it will be, like a little dream. Imagine, as you get older, what your life is like already. Look back over the decades, and what do you see? It's like it was just a breath of air, just like a moment. And the older we get, the quicker time seems to pass by. Your whole life now, you can see it. Your whole life will be like that. When you finally are in his presence, you'll look at your whole life like that, and it'll seem but a moment. The thing about it is your journey just began, and you'll discover that your real destiny is unbounded. Your past was bounded and finite. Your future is unbounded. It's really because of the life of Christ in you. The final question, do you want to be made well? The final question is this one. And it's a penetrating question that he asked Peter three times. You know it. Peter, do you love me? This is a question, too, that he'll raise from time to time. Do you love me more than these? That's a big question. When he says, do you love me more than these? Who are the these? What do you think? There are commentators don't agree on what the these are. Would he be referring to the great catch of fish and thereby meaning this, that your vocation, your occupation, your career? Could he mean that? Could it mean that he's referring to these, the other disciples? Do you love me more than them? There are other options for that, but here's the thing. Do you love me more than any rival? And this will be tested, I promise you, on a day-by-day basis. Because you see, you are not going to control Jesus. When you received him, you may have come to him because you wanted the gift of eternal life or because of despair or any other unworthy reason. Because he'll stoop to conquer. If it's the fear of hell, fine. If that's it, fine. But ultimately, you're going to discover that his real desire is for you to love him for himself and not for his gifts. That'll take time. That will not happen overnight. But I want to suggest here that as we move in that direction of coming to see him, his desire is for us to come to love him in new levels. And the more we allow him to really become enfleshed and manifest in our lives, the more we will have a real reality, more authentic, the more real we become as human beings. The gospel has been well defined, and this is where I quit, as God's offer of his power to make us become the people he always intended us to be.
This concludes Dr. Ken Boa's teaching. For more information about Reflections Ministries, please visit us on the web at www.reflectionsministries.org.